is 70 degrees Racine, 68 now in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It was a great pleasure to have Dr. Jerry Mast, a faculty colleague of mine from Carthage College, professor of political science, on the morning show just as the Republican National Convention was opening in Milwaukee and just days after the assassination attempt against Donald Trump. And I'm so glad that we can have Professor Mast back now on the eve of the Democratic National Convention, which begins today in Chicago. And it's kind of remarkable to think about all that has happened since Professor Mast's last visit to the program, including incumbent President Joe Biden's decision to step out of a bid for re-election, elevating, of course, Kamala Harris, in effect, as the new presumptive presidential nominee, and of course Kamala Harris's decision of choice for a running mate, and what the numbers look like now in terms of Trump versus Harris, and so on. A lot to think about, a lot to talk about, a lot to cover, and so I'm so glad that just back from vacation, Professor Mast is willing to make time for this return visit to the morning show. Professor Mast, we welcome you back.
Thanks, Greg. It's good to be here. It feels like a year's worth of events packed into a couple of weeks.
Doesn't it, though? It's just incredible. I did re-listen to our last conversation, and one of the things that was really just kind of striking was to think back to at that point in time when President Biden was still in office and at least publicly was professing his intention to stay in the race. But you really did not pull any punches. You said you could not foresee a circumstance in which President Biden was going to be able to, in fact, stay the course. And, of course, that proved to be the way it turned out. I'm curious about your reaction, even if it is something you expected President Biden to do, if you were surprised by any of the circumstances under which that announcement was ultimately made or when it was made and so on.
Well, there's a pretty solid theory in political science elaborated in a book called The Party Decides, a theory of elections and party politics that says essentially parties make these key decisions in electoral politics, and that kind of runs counter. We think that voters might decide, and politicians themselves are in charge, but really the party as a whole, as a structure, is particularly important. And it became clear that there were enough members at the grassroots level who were not enamored with the idea of Mr. Biden as the candidate, who would prefer somebody else, that elites within the party, members of Congress, office holders, and so forth, increasingly thought that their own prospects were damaged by a weak candidate at the top of the ticket. began to reassess their view of the likelihood that Mr. Biden would be able to successfully win re-election. And so it just seemed to me at the time that the pressure would grow and grow and grow and become, I mean, technically he could have just stuck it out, but at some point you realize that the party is coming apart. And this morning, Ron Klain, Mr. Biden's first chief of staff, made this comment, and he said that, you know, Mr. Biden did feel that he could win the election and still feels that, but came to the realization that the party was going to divide, become divided over his candidacy. And so was I surprised? You know, no, but it's just still remarkable, right? So it took a lot of pressure to get him into that headspace, right? So Nancy Pelosi, perhaps most effectively, pressured him to come out. Mr. Barack Obama did as well. Mr. Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries, the minority leader in the House of Representatives, also met with him, and these messages just made him realize that continuing was not a fruitful, productive path for him personally in a historical sense or the party.
Right. You know, as you're describing your sort of personal, maybe emotional reaction to it, I'm reminded of my own. I remember my wife and I were on our way out the door, heading up to, I don't know, Milwaukee or someplace. And just as I was going to turn the TV off, this news crawl comes at the bottom of the screen, President Biden withdraws. And I remember being just shocked and yet not surprised.
Yes.
And, you know, sometimes you hear that strange phrase of something that's shocking and yet not surprising. And like you know it's coming, you expect it's coming, and yet you're not kind of fully prepared for what that means, so momentous.
I would say that the last 10 years, roughly, with the arrival of Mr. Trump on the political scene, the national political scene, have made American politics less predictable, right? And so we're in this kind of era, and it's not simply him. He's not the only vehicle for this uncertainty. The conditions that allowed Mr. Trump to arrive are perhaps the better source of this uncertainty. So we're in this time of uncertainty, and so it's hard to predict. If you pay close attention to news, you get a sense of what's likely to come, and so when it comes, you're not surprised. But because the times have now shifted and changed, the norms are all up for grabs. It can still be shocking.
Yeah. One other thing, and then, of course, we have a lot to get onto. As you were describing the fact that in some respects these kind of decisions or choices ultimately get at least sort of unofficially made by the party as a whole, even though if officially it is the individual who decides to step down. Not that it's at all the same circumstances, but I'm kind of reminded of President Nixon's decision to resign from office. And the fact that, you know, from everything I've read, it was when some of his most loyal fellow Republicans from Congress paid him a visit and spelled out the dire situation.
Right.
That is what ultimately
we've done
persuaded.
The head counting. You're not going to survive if you don't
right.
sit down.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, at any rate, that is the decision that was made. And Kamala Harris has found herself. Now, I mean, I suppose in a sense, still is the presumptive Democratic nominee for president. Tell me about some of your reactions to the way she has stepped into the spotlight. And I don't mean anything involving her running mate. We'll get to that. But just Kamala Harris herself and this rather dramatic elevation into a spotlight that she really hasn't been in before.
Yeah, I would say that a key element of this, the kind of dramatic character of the last 3 weeks has been the remarkable degree to which she has rallied the party behind her. And so to go back to your point about the kind of the larger party playing a role in deciding key sorts of things, you know, it was not clear who would take the mantle of nominee if Mr. Biden stepped down, right? If we go back a month, and so you know, there were those who everybody said, well, Harris has to be in the running, right? But there was plenty of people who argued for a kind of mini primary, some competition for the nomination. So that heading into Chicago for the convention, that there would be some kind of substantive decision to be made, right? And I mean, Barack Obama came out and suggested that this is what he supported. There was Ms. Pelosi said she supported some kind of competition for this. Many, many pundits argued for this. And of course, it didn't happen, right? I mean, the party just coalesced around Ms. Harris. In part, I think because there was this palpable sense of overwhelming relief on the part of many Democrats that Mr. Biden had decided to step down, and that the party could move to somebody who would be more capable of uniting the party. So part of that, and then the potential competitors for the nomination, you know, Governors Whitmer in Michigan, Shapiro in Pennsylvania, Pritzker perhaps in Illinois, Newsom in California, Pete Buttigieg, the Secretary of Transportation. These kind of conventional possibilities, all of them just chose not to run and not to challenge Ms. Harris. And in part, I think that one of the reasons why is that Ms. Harris has just really conducted herself in a very impressive way. Mm-hmm. You know, if we go back to 2019 when she was vying for the nomination for the 2020 presidential election, I mean, she was okay, but not terribly impressive as a candidate, and her reputation coming out of that contest, you know, what wasn't super impressive. Her reputation as the vice president is mixed at best. And so many Democrats, I think, were kind of debating, well, do we want to rally behind Ms. Harris while Mr. Biden was still, you know, in the running? And so there was real question marks around her. And she's answered them emphatically by putting together a really competent, charismatic campaign to this point.
One of the and I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I think for a lot of us, even who absolutely know better, it's still really easy to kind of trip into the misassumption that because she was Vice President Kamala Harris, that just meant she should be and would be the person who would step into the spot that President Biden vacated. And of course, being vice president doesn't really mean that at all. I mean, it does set you up with some, I suppose, advantages and so on. But it was not a foregone conclusion. And you're reminding us that there was the very real possibility that these last few weeks would have played out very differently than, in fact, they have.
I think that's generally true. But I think it's even more true in the case of the current administration. Because of this, I don't think that President Biden used Ms. Harris a lot in key effective kinds of ways.
She's not been all that high profile compared to some vice presidents.
Correct. But also, which isn't to say she's done nothing. She has been involved in a number of things and has certainly exposed herself to the job of being president. But another and perhaps more important factor here, I think, is that the Biden administration just has chosen to take a pretty low profile within the media. The president himself held very few press conferences. The president himself didn't deliver many public speeches. He just kept out of the public eye. And we can kind of speculate, well, maybe that's because, you know, his aging has, you know, degraded some of his communication skills, and they just made a decision that maybe it's in their best interest not to put him on this public stage. But if the president isn't going to be in the public eye, certainly the vice president isn't going to either. And so we're at a point where You know, Ms. Harris has very good name recognition. People know, for the most part, who the vice president is. But her story is not all that well known. And so these past 3 weeks have been important for her to kind of introduce herself. And, of course, the convention, the Democratic National Convention this week will, you know, I think there's a handful of important purposes that the convention will have to try to achieve. But amongst those is the kind of fleshing out of Ms. Harris's biography.
Right. Who she is, what she stands for,
right.
And what a President Kamala Harris might look like and be.
Right.
Of course, one of the most critical things that occurred in the last few weeks was Kamala Harris choosing a running mate. And she had an interesting array of possibilities before her. Talk to us about that process and then ultimately the choice that she made.
Yeah, pretty quickly, the list of candidates centered on Mark Kelly, senator from Arizona, former fighter pilot for the Navy and former astronaut, the husband of Gabby Giffords, representative from Arizona, who was very egregiously wounded in an assassination attempt. So Mr. Kelly, Josh Shapiro, kind of rising star within the party, governor of Pennsylvania, critical state, kind of moderate, and Andy Beshear, Democratic governor of a very red state, Kentucky.
Hmm.
So the ability for a Democrat to compete successfully amongst a pool of voters who are kind of predisposed to oppose Democrats is certainly a plum, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And then Roy Cooper, the governor of North Carolina, again similar. North Carolina is not as Republican as Kentucky, but it is red-ish. And so these men all kind of represented a kind of acknowledgement, right? That perhaps it makes sense to balance the ticket demographically. A woman of color at the top of the ticket, a white man in the VP position would give the ticket some balance in that regard. And then, of course, Mr. Walls kind of becomes this later consideration and a series of interviews that he did in national media sources, Morning Joe on MSNBC in particular, really kind of elevated his profile, and obviously he is the one she felt most comfortable running with.
We were talking before we went on the air about the impression that he has made in a relatively short amount of time. I did want to take a moment to talk about that event at which he was announced as her running mate. If I remember correctly, the gentleman from Pennsylvania, now I'm blanking on his name.
Shapiro.
Shapiro was there and spoke so eloquently and passionately on behalf of Tim Walz. I mean, at a moment when he had in effect been passed over. That, to me, was a really impressive moment and an important moment, and it kind of speaks to what you were saying earlier in terms of, although we think of very specific individuals and what they do and do not do or say, that also was indicative of this is bigger than that. This is also about a party rallying, and it seems to me he played an important part in that.
Yes, with I would say just maybe a minor caveat, and I thought so. Mr. Shapiro's very deserved reputation is that he's very charismatic and dynamic as a speaker, and I agree with you in terms of your assessment of his speech. It was enormously dynamic, and moving, and it generated a ton of excitement in the venue. But it almost, to me, came across as, I'm going to show you why you made the wrong decision in picking Mr. Walls kind of speech, right? I'm going to perform so well, I'm going to set the bar really high,
right?
And so then they have to come up and follow up on
yeah,
that, right?
Right. which to some extent they did. Especially
they did.
Tim Walz. Yeah. I must confess, I knew the name and nothing else about him until now, and it's really intriguing all that he brings to the ticket.
Yeah, I think that outside of Minnesota, Mr. Walz is not well known. And so, the last week or so, and this convention, of course, will be about making him more well known. Man, I think he's 60, 61, originally from Nebraska, a public school teacher.
Football coach.
In Nebraska. Then they moved to Minnesota early in their adulthood and their teaching careers. His wife is from, also a public teacher, but she's from Minnesota. And also a football coach, yes. A hunter, a fisherman, and a 24-year member of the National Guard. So he has these kinds of biographical characteristics that make him feel almost like a stereotypical Midwesterner.
Hmm. You wrote at one point on in a Facebook post, I mentioned this before we went on the air, I wanted to give you a chance to talk about this turn of phrase. At one point you said, she, meaning Kamala Harris and Tim Walz, passed the eyeball test. What did you mean by that phrase?
Well, both of them have seemed large enough for the occasion, right? So to be on the stage contending for the presidency and the vice presidency, this is clearly the biggest prize in American politics. It could well be the biggest prize in the world politics. Mm. It is the most important, most powerful position in the world, really, in many respects. It's a one-way ticket into the history books, no matter how well you do or don't do. And so the amount of pressure and scrutiny is really literally hard to fathom for someone who hasn't been in that situation. And so how will people perform under pressure in that regard? And it's not always clear, right, that people are cut out for this. And I would say that, you know, if we go back to 2019, again, Ms. Harris was all right, but not great as a candidate. And many people felt, you know, yeah, maybe, but it's not clear. Mr. Walz, Midwestern governor, it's an important position to attain, and people who become governors of states like, you know, Iowa and Minnesota and Michigan have accomplished important things. But that said, it's not like striving for the White House. And so when Mr. Biden endorsed Ms. Harris, I mean, I think lots of people were asking themselves, is she going to perform well, right? Is she going to be cut out for that? When she announced Mr. Walz was her running mate, many people were wondering, well, how's he actually going to do? Mm. And both of them have been, at a minimum, very competent and perhaps much more than that in terms of connecting with crowds, given, you know, the enormously enthusiastic and large crowds that they're speaking to. The numbers, survey data, all suggest that they are what we see, right? The eyeball test, right, is actually simply not just your own kind of subjective reaction to them, but publicly, right? Other people are also reacting positively, certainly within the Democratic Party.
Right. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Jerry Mast, professor of political science at Carthage College, and until now, we have scarcely mentioned the name of the Republican nominee for president, of course, Donald Trump, hoping to regain the White House in this upcoming presidential or current presidential campaign. Talk about the way in which President Biden's decision to step down and for Mr. Trump to suddenly have a completely different opponent, the way in which that has posed something of a challenge for him in terms of how to handle this, how to respond, what to say, and so on.
It's been an enormous challenge. So one of my favorite journalists is a man by the name of Tim Alberta, who's written several books on American politics, And he is a staff writer for the Atlantic magazine. And this spring, he wrote a piece on the Trump campaign, very well researched. He did a lot of interviewing over multiple days with the campaign chairs for the Trump campaign. And so we laid it out, right? And the general thrust of Mr. Alberta's assessment of the campaign is that, one, they're focused intensely on painting Mr. Biden as a man in decline, very old, becoming more feeble and weak, and contrasting that picture of the president with Mr. Trump as an energetic, strong figure. That was their whole focus, that was the purpose of the campaign. And in addition to that, Mr. Alberta very effectively conveyed an enormous sense of optimism on the part of the campaign itself, that they were convinced, not just that they would win, but they would win convincingly, that it wouldn't be a narrow election like we've seen in the last number of cycles, but rather a something of a landslide. and of course, with Mr. Biden deciding to step down, they no longer have this person around whom they've built the logic of their campaign, and so and moreover, I mean, you can go even farther. The replacement of Mr. Biden with Ms. Harris has turned the logic of their campaign on its head. Now all of a sudden, it is Mr. Trump who's the older candidate, the oldest candidate for president we've ever had at this point, and so they're need to pivot from the logic of their campaign to something else, right? To kind of effectively respond to circumstances was both really, really great, and they have not done a good job to this point in making that pivot.
I remember that when I hope we can just spend a little bit of time talking about a rather remarkable news conference or press conference that Mr. Trump gave, I think, in Mar-a-Lago, I think the first since Kamala Harris became the presumptive nominee. And it was fascinating to listen to what he focused upon. And it was all about size of crowds and this sort of thing. And this is when he sort of famously, maybe infamously, said things about, you know, drawing bigger crowds than Martin Luther King had for I Had to Have a Dream and so on. But this, it seemed to be a picture of a candidate in crisis in terms of really kind of flailing, not knowing exactly who their opponent was or what he needed to be talking about in that moment. Was that your impression too?
Yes, I agree with that. In many respects, it's difficult to characterize Mr. Trump in terms of how he's doing, in part because he is such an unusual politician, so outside the norm of American politicians, that the general rules that you would apply to, oh, is this a good speech or a bad speech? Is this appropriate or inappropriate? They don't apply to him, right? So he's in many ways disrupted the framework by which we think about American politicians and American speeches,
right, and what works or what's effective,
right,
and recognizing
and then characterizing changes within the category of Trump discourse is difficult, and yet I do think we are seeing a shift or change in the degree of incoherence or irrelevancy, or what we might say is just simply inappropriate, calling people names. I mean, this is kind of, you know, middle school level playground behavior, right? Name calling and so, you know, one of the things that elevated Governor Walz's profile and I think helped build the case for him as vice president is that he famously or infamously, I guess, depending on one's perspective, termed Donald Trump and J.D. Vance weird, right? And you know, I think that term of being weird stuck and had relevance in part because to listen to a 78-year-old man who was president and is trying to be president again claim that he's more physically attractive than Kamala Harris, you know, and going on and on about that, making up lies about fake images of her crowds and so forth. That is weird. That is weird.
Well, and moreover, one of the words you used as you were talking was something about relevancy or irrelevancy or something. I think when you talked about kind of the way his rhetoric perhaps is starting to tilt, it's that when you think about those who are disgruntled or feel like they have been kind of left behind or not listened to or this and that, I mean, the things, at least particularly in this press conference that Donald Trump was talking about, have nothing to do with
who should be president.
Right. Well, or what he is going to do for them. Right. I mean, for those right. who are so devoted right. to him. I mean, not to say that the center of his core have been shaken from their devotion to him, but that doesn't – focusing on those kind of things seems so transparently self-serving as opposed to thinking about – those people out there you want to be voting for him and supporting him.
Yes. I mean, never mind the kind of clearly incoherent rhetorical directions he can go in, like talking about Hannibal Lecter or talking about sharks and boat batteries and how would you prefer to die. Those sorts of kind of really odd or weird, to use Mr. Walz's terms, kind of rhetorical tactics or strategies, really miss the larger point of why would you have a presidential campaign, right? I mean, it really needs to be about what are the country's problems, what are the appropriate solutions to them. And Mr. Trump has been pressured publicly, and I'm sure privately, by other Republicans to stop this approach to speaking about Harris and Walz on a personal level, stop with the insults and kind of build the case as a matter of policy, that she is too liberal for the country, that her policies would be ineffective or inappropriate. But even when he does that, right, he's so used to speaking in almost buffoonish or cartoonish levels of exaggeration. Like, it's not that Ms. Harris is very liberal. Of course she is, but it's that she's a radical Marxist, which of course she's not. So using these kinds of terms, right, I think undermines the potential effectiveness of a case that could be made against her.
Right. The other thing is, in terms of what it projects, is that obviously the reason many people are drawn to Donald Trump is that he is for them a figure of imposing strength and overwhelming confidence. And for many people, that's the star they want to hitch themselves to. That seems like the kind of person you want running the country and leading us. And some of what we're talking about now in terms of the shift of his rhetoric does not project that same sense right. of confidence. This seems like someone flailing and struggling.
Yeah, very insecure and afraid. Right, of circumstances. I agree with that.
So in terms of what happens from this point, and I was going to say, with that news conference, another somewhat remarkable thing was it had been some days since he had made any kind of campaign appearance at all. And of course, part of that might be in the wake of the assassination attempt in Pennsylvania and perhaps the need for the Trump campaign to rethink the logistics and location of some of his appearances. I haven't been following close enough to know if he has resumed his previous pace, but what would you think needs to be his strategy moving forward?
Well, he has never been a conventional campaigner. He has become enamored with these big rallies. And he's been holding a rally a week, roughly speaking, and then, you know, golfing and holding an impromptu press conference in which it's not a really conventional press conference, in which there's a kind of regular back and forth over issues that the press corps raises with the candidate. It's him going on and veering into these kinds of kind of rhetorical, I'd call them indulgences, that might play well to his strongest supporters, right? But a conventional campaign needs to focus on people who you haven't won over yet, right? Mm. And so looking at the people in the middle of the electorate, the independents, swing voters, it's hard to see how the kinds of speeches that Mr. Trump has been given recently are going to play well there.
Right.
The data suggests that they're not, right? And so we've seen a roughly 5 percentage point swing in the national head-to-head polling numbers, moving from what was a couple percentage point deficit for Mr. Biden to a couple percentage point advantage for Ms. Harris. The New York Times Siena College polls of the swing states last week, the blue wall states, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, and then just a couple days ago, the Sun Belt swing states, Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, North Carolina. All of those polls suggest that independents are breaking for Ms. Harris. Not by a lot, a couple percentage points, that's within margin of error. But, you know, a month ago, Mr. Trump was enjoying a lead there. And so, again, I just want to emphasize the importance of campaigns focusing on the people who aren't in their category already. And it's not clear to me that the Trump campaign has somehow figured that out. I mean, the campaign might have figured it out, but Mr. Trump himself is hard to manage.
Right, right. And, of course, what elected him president when he defeated Hillary Clinton was not his base. I mean, his base was a big part of it, obviously,
right.
but it was voters in the middle who, for various reasons,
let's give this guy a chance.
Yeah, pulled away from Hillary Clinton and voted for Donald Trump, and one has a sense. I wonder if you would that for Donald Trump as a candidate, it is much more fun, much more viscerally pleasurable, if you will, for him to play to those that are already so devoted to him. But the whole matter of trying to woo people in the middle who at this moment are unconvinced, that's in a sense harder work and a trickier challenge.
Yeah, I mean, part of it might be that it's more fun. Part of it might be that it just meets some kind of psychological need that he has. But it hasn't worked very well since 2016, right? I mean, he lost the 2018 midterms. Democrats retook Congress. Many of the most kind of, we might call them MAGA candidates for Congress, lost their bids. He lost the 2020 presidential election. The Republicans took the House in the 2022 midterm elections, but only by the narrowest of margins, and the Democrats, rather, were able to hold on to the Senate. So what most people kind of reasonably predicted would be a very large Republican victory in the 22 midterms was not. And so it seems to me that if you look at the historical pattern of electoral outcomes, the Trump campaign has to figure out a way to get Mr. Trump to move out of this kind of MAGA framework and appeal to independents and moderates.
Of course, one of the issues that in which there seems to be at least a little bit of vulnerability on Kamala Harris's part is the vexing issue of immigration. And there are plenty of ads that are running right now that are attempting to hit her pretty hard. Do you see that as a good way to go to hammer on that particular issue? And what does candidate Harris do in response?
Yeah, I think that that's one of the strategies. So Mr. Trump has enjoyed a couple of advantages in terms of the degree to which voters trust him more than they trusted Mr. Biden originally, right, for much of the year, and then Ms. Harris in the wake of Mr. Biden stepping down. And those issues in particular are the economy and, second, immigration. Now, the advantage that Mr. Trump enjoyed with respect to more trust in his leadership on the economy has really eroded. And Ms. Harris has really moved her numbers up to almost being on a par with Mr. Trump. So that advantage is kind of diminished. But the immigration advantage that he has enjoyed has persisted, at least to this point. And so you see, in terms of the commercials, Ms. Harris perhaps triangulating a little bit, moving, trying to shift to the center on some things. She stole his issue on taxes for tip income. Is an example of this. She has pledged to not go after or outlawing fracking of oil and gas, hydraulic fracturing, which is a shift. Again, kind of shifting to the center to try to compete for critical swing voters. With respect to immigration, right? I mean, I think that there's potential for Mr. Trump to use this to his advantage, but peril as well, right? And so, to the extent that he is prone to veering off into very ethnocentric, nativist kinds of rhetoric, that seems potentially dangerous. But it's also clear that many Americans are concerned about illegal immigration and would like to see some sort of reform. The Democrats have a good counter, and that is that there was a bipartisan reform of immigration negotiated in the spring, it was torpedoed in the House of Representatives at the request of Mr. Trump himself. And so their argument, right, is that, look, no, we really do support immigration reform and border security. It's Mr. Trump who is only using this as a political issue. He's not as interested in real reform, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, that question of which candidate is more committed is a key kind of thing that they're going to be arguing about, I think, moving forward.
Right. One of the things I saw you posting about on Facebook that I think is worth talking about for a couple of minutes is this matter of, in your words, controlling the news cycle. A very, very important thing. You want to be, as much as possible, as a candidate for president, being the one who is pushing the buttons and flipping the levers in terms of what the media is going to be covering and talking about and so on. But in your words, right now, the Trump campaign looks like a dumpster fire in terms of having really lost control of the news cycle in a lot of different ways. What are the forces at play that are really keeping or have kept the Trump campaign from being able to control the news cycle as they would prefer?
Well, it starts, of course, with the sitting president deciding to not seek re-election. That's enormously unusual. He had won all of the delegates in the primaries. He is convinced, pressured to step down. That's obviously a key historic level kind of event. And so it's going to be really difficult for his opponent to kind of elbow his way in to the discussion there. The next big event that is triggered by that decision is, well, who will replace him, right? And so, of course, the media is going to obsessively focus on this question of who will his replacement be. That quickly became, right, a settled sort of question, a remarkably fast settling of it. And so, you know, Ms. Harris becomes this new story, right? And so, of course, the media is going to pay a lot of attention to her. In short order, she's got a big decision to make, right? The biggest decision a nominee can make, and that is who is the vice president, presidential nominee, going to be. Again, the media is going to focus on understandably on Ms. Harris for that. She's made that decision, and she's, you know, put together a bunch of very conventional campaign events and has done very well at it. And the positive response on the part of I mean, she's really, this is all very much transformed the entire election. And so the fact that you can transform an election in a couple of weeks is itself enormously newsworthy. And so people are focusing on that. And now, of course, she has her convention that's starting today. And so media is going to pay attention to that. So they're like tidal forces moving in a particular direction. And Mr. Trump is, you know, trying to swim against this tide.
Don't forget about me.
Right. And maybe that explains a little bit of his rhetorical excesses, his inflammatory language, and so forth, in order to try to attract some attention. And again, there's media attention is a double-edged sword. So, right. I mean, they need to be careful about how they go about changing the news cycle and how they go about generating media attention.
Right. And then, of course, on top of it, I know you have made mention from time to time of this D.C. District Judge, Tanya Chutkan, and a case involving the insurrection back in 2021, and whether or not that case sort of moves forward attracts attention of its own that I would think candidate Trump
So the road ahead has some real potential problems for the Trump campaign. In a couple weeks after the Democratic convention comes to an end, we're going to have the sentencing in New York over the fraud convictions involving the hush money to Stormy Daniels. That obviously will attract a bunch of attention. And, of course, there is this ongoing federal case in the D.C. District Court involving charges dealing with insurrection from January 6th. So the Supreme Court earlier this year issued a pretty sweeping decision granting an enormous amount of presidential immunity to presidents, protecting them from criminal prosecution for official acts. The key there is for official acts. And so the case against Mr. Trump over January 6th will need to involve the prosecutor, Jack Smith, building an argument that's convincing to the court that attempting to overturn the election can't be understood to be an official act of the president. And so the official act of the president is to respect or acknowledge the outcome of elections, and that if it can be shown that Mr. Trump did not, right, then he still remains vulnerable to these legal charges. And so that there's no real chance that that case can be settled before the election culminates in November, but they can hold proceedings, right? They can hold the trial, and that will require Mr. Trump to be involved, and that will detract from his focus on the campaign, and of course his ability to control media over that is going to be difficult.
Well, needless to say, this is already a presidential campaign like none we have ever seen, and the way matters have changed quite dramatically has really been remarkable to follow, disconcerting as well.
Well, what hasn't changed is how close things really are, right?
Right.
I mean, the really, if you had to pick somebody who has an advantage at this point, you know, I think it's objectively Ms. Harris has made herself a minor front runner. But it's only minor. Perhaps the best way to characterize it is it's still a bit of a toss-up.
Right. It is a very, very close race, that is for sure. And we appreciate all of the insights that you have offered and have offered today, and look forward to connecting with you again as events proceed towards November. Dr. Gerald Mast, professor of political science here at Carthage College, I really appreciate every opportunity I have to talk with you on the morning show, and thank you for making time for this conversation today.
Well, thank you for having me, Greg.
Tomorrow on the morning show, the co-authors of a book called Microskills. On Wednesday, the author of a book called Remaking the Spaces Between Us, which is an interesting look at the political divide in our country right now. On Thursday, Dr. Art Sear joins us. And on Friday, Ian O'Connor, sports writer, and his marvelous new biography of Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers, former Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers, a book called Out of the Darkness. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Today is going to be sunny, breezy, and pleasant with a high of 76 degrees. No swimming allowed, however, in Lake Michigan until tomorrow afternoon. Partly cloudy overnight with a low of 58. Sunny tomorrow and a high of 72. And pleasant weather continues most of the week. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha Racine.